you can always learn from these people, and it's important to surround yourself with people who inspire you all the time. So if you're nervous about talking to someone who's got a very high profile, then that's the reason to do it. Of course, these people have interesting stories, but everyone has a conversation and an interesting story. Generally, they all love to inspire young players or enthusiastic people coming up and asking something enthusiastic. You have to put the shyness aside and just go and speak and have a conversation with them. You just have to find out.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. The podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the recording, writing and performing processes with the likes of Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, The Beatles, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Oasis, Morrissey, Alanis Morissette, Beyonce, The 1975, Bob Dylan and Kraftwerk. Today we are joined by Lucy Landymore, who has worked on both Hans Zimmer Live and the World of Hans Zimmer shows, as well as working alongside Pharrell Williams, Charlie XCX, Stuart Copeland and Johnny Marr of The Smiths. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Lucy Landymore. Thanks for joining us today, Lucy. How's it going?
Good, thank you. Thanks, Chris. It's really great to be here.
Nice one. Now, you once said that your first long-term teacher was a guy called Mark Aldous, and he was great but strict, which pushed me further. Tell us about Mark Aldous and what was his philosophy to perhaps your development and teaching, and maybe which parts of that would you incorporate if you were developing others, and which would you put aside?
My parents are also music teachers, so he was working as a music teacher in the same schools as my parents, and that was the scary part about him, because anything I would do in the lesson, he would then go to tell my parents during the week. And we also had a percussion group. He was conducting the percussion group, but he was composing all the pieces that we would play. And that was really great. And I didn't value that until I grew up and realized how special that is. Not all these percussion teachers compose like that. During percussion group, because we all got on so well, there were a lot of jokes and I was laughing a lot. But laughter is great when you're trying to learn something. It's really important to associate the learning with having fun. So I don't regret any part of it. But the problem was I would laugh and then he would go and tell my parents the next week. And then my parents would tell me, don't laugh during percussion group. But then during our individual lessons, he was very good with me. We learned tune percussion together and we learned drum kit together. And on drum kit, I realized this is going to go out as a podcast and people are going to hear this. But I used to be scared of doing fills because that's suddenly the bit where you're really expressing yourself, aren't you? And when you express yourself, you're letting something out from deep inside you. It is quite a brave thing to do. To improvise on the spot or composing is also letting a part out from inside you. And he used to be very strict with me about that. He used to just make me do it. He didn't wait around. He just said, just play a paradiddle or something. And each week he would just be really pushy. He was making me learn pieces, but also very nice and encouraging. It was really good to have him as a teacher. I think very fondly about him.
That's great to hear, because these people sometimes play a pivotal role in where we go to, and we sometimes don't get the chance to give them as much credit. If you were teaching someone, is there anything that you would do differently in that kind of philosophy to develop even that approach?
I grew up with the graded system, so I went through grades 1 to 8, and I was teaching for a bit. I was teaching at the Perth School in Cambridge, which is a private school with young ages until, I think it's until 10 or 12, can't remember. And I made all of the students compose a piece themselves because I thought it was very interesting to see what people come up with before they've even learnt the rock beat on the drums. And they came up with some really interesting stuff. Like one boy, he didn't even hit the drum skins to start with. He was just playing around on the rims. And that was lovely. And I wrote all of their pieces in Sibelius. So while they were messing around frantically, I was trying to transcribe it live in Sibelius. And I managed most of the time. And then I made them into proper pieces. I let them name them, and they had a lot of fun with that. And one was called Marshmallow Clouds or something. And then I made a book out of it. And I think they were really pleased with that. But then that encourages creativity and lets you know that in music, there is no right and wrong. You can do whatever you like. Of course, wrong notes are a thing if you're learning a piece, and it's nicer if you play all the right notes. But when it comes to expressing yourself, it's very important not to attach yourself to that.
And you went to, you studied at Royal College of Music. And if you hadn't have gone to that particular place, how do you think your career path would have panned out? Do you think you'd have been in a very similar place? Do you think that, that was pivotal? And what were the kind of key elements you took away from doing a degree at that place?
I really loved the Royal College of Music, because you go there and then everyone puts the same importance on music as you, of course. And if I hadn't have gone, it was the people there who were the most important, just being around the same people who were inspired by the same things as you and seeing what they're capable of. And then once you see what someone else can do, you think it's possible yourself, don't you? And then suddenly you think of something else and ideas bloom. That's what's important about that. Also, I met a lot of colleagues there who have become colleagues later in life as well. I've got work through those people, and vice versa as well. If I want to put on a gig, then I want to ask my friends from college to do it, because I trust them and I like them and I'm inspired by them. But I also went to the junior college, which is on Saturdays, and that was when I was a teenager. That was also very important for my musical upbringing. And we had, my favorite part was percussion group, but we also had things like a choir and music theory lessons, composition lessons, harmony lessons. It was the whole thing that you would learn in college, but just as a Saturday school. And that, because the atmosphere is a bit more relaxed, it's just an extracurricular rather than having a strict exam, which you feel like is going to have an impact in your life. It had a different vibe about it. And I don't really know how to explain it, but when you take this pressure off, you also find something else in the music and in the people who inspire you and really have an effect later in your life.
And that probably Saturday routine probably took the sting out of going into somewhere like the Royal College of Music and being feeling really out of your depth or kind of intimidated perhaps by being in somewhere like that. Obviously, your parents being music teachers would have given you probably technical advice and that kind of thing. Did either of them ever suggest not going into the music industry? Because a lot of people who've been around the music industry for many years, particularly coming into the age we're in, which is harder and harder for people to make a full-time living out of it, like, what were your parents' stance, having been in the music world, about the prospect of you being a musician?
They really pushed me to be a musician, actually. I came home from school and I had homework, and some of it was art. I quite liked art, but my parents would say, no, don't do that. Do that later. Practice first. So I would always do that. And I know a lot of my friends were, their parents would say to them, no, you should concentrate on your lawyer studies or something. And you should try to be a doctor. I had never had that.
Did you have like a plan B? You know, you're young age and you obviously, you know, people don't really think about their careers at that type of age. Did you, or did they have a plan B for you, or did they feel that going through the creative process of being a musician, you'll grow so much that wherever you end up, it'll help in your progression?
Yeah, I guess I was pushed into the deep end from a young age, or not even that, but just pushed in one direction. And myself as well, I pushed myself in that direction. I didn't see any other, I wasn't interested in anything else like music. I was so fascinated by music in every way. But there was a time at Sixth Form College when the teachers were asking, I don't know if, I think Hills Road Sixth Form College is quite famous, actually. It's quite well known in Cambridge. And they were asking me, what do I want to do for my second year? And I said, I need some time to practice music, and that's what I really want to do. So is it possible for me to just do 3 A-levels, please? And they said, but what are you going to do? Because you need a backup plan. And I said, I don't want a backup plan. I want to be a musician. And then they were really quite serious about me having a backup plan. So I had to do something that I don't remember. Guess I was probably practicing instead. Yeah. It was use of maths or something like that, which it is quite useful. Yeah, it is. But if I had to have a backup plan, if I lost an arm or a leg, then I would just play as a 3-limb drummer or 2 limbs, or I would find a way. If I lost everything, then I would compose. If anything happens, I have something, compositional playing
But within this, so there'll be lots of people listening to this who would have been a similar age, you know, who maybe did compromise. And that unwavering focus is clearly something that's got you to where you are. But I guess the kind of other thing in the back of the mind is, when you said, oh, just compose and, like, you know, do some percussion, it's like the paid work that's actually going to pay the bills and put the roof over the head. That's the kind of, often we have a lot of people who are in this kind of limbo, that they will be incredibly talented, but it's, I've got to pay my bills and that kind of thing. And so were you confident at that age that gigs would naturally come to you through your kind of the work that you were doing that would mean that you didn't have to worry about that stuff?
I remember I was worried after college because I was in my overdraft, and I thought, when's this going to get back to zero? But then I was very lucky. I was a little nervous that summer after I graduated. And also, when you've just been through 4 years of intense music, then I had a kind of a motivation problem. I haven't told many people this, actually, but I think everyone goes through this after you've just finished 4 years of intense college. Sometimes I walked into my practice room, looked at every instrument in there, and then I walked out again because I felt a bit overwhelmed. I don't know where to start anymore. But then luckily, that was July 2014 I graduated, and then September 2014 I got an email from Mike Dolbear asking about the first Hans Zimmer show. And that was going to be in the Hammersmith Apollo in 2014. So he said, just send some videos, send biographies, send some photos, and let's see if we can get you into the show. And then it worked. And I was very happy about that. We performed in the Hammersmith Apollo. I had a surdo and a djembe and some V drums to play on. And it was just the best experience ever. And I was so starstruck by everyone around me.
And that was, I believe, Hans Zimmer's first live performance as well. I might be wrong about that, but the first live performance in that kind of setting. I mean, you must have had imposter syndrome in that situation. Like, obviously, a fantastic email to get. And you said about being starstruck around all these people. To some level, you must have thought, wow, that is a huge ascension. You know, this is kind of a career-defining gig for a lot of musicians, and you're straight in there after college, which is amazing. But I guess, actually, as an experienced musician, he would have also had a little bit of apprehension and anxiety performing. Is that something you picked up on at all?
It's quite public that he used to have stage fright, but it's quite recent as well that he used to have stage fright. And now he doesn't have stage fright, I think, at all. And he's very happy to chat to the audience for hours. He could chat to the audience for hours if there wasn't a time limit on the booking of the arena that night. But yeah, that first performance, yeah, apparently he did have a lot of stage fright. In the first tour we did in 2016 as well, he was quite nervous, but in the most charming way. He's so charming, isn't he? On stage. It's really lovely.
It's interesting. And I wonder what you would advise someone who is working alongside someone of profile who is actually demonstrating nerves, because you probably just make the assumption as a young musician, oh, this kind of experienced person is going to be fine about this, but actually they get nerves as well and stage fright. How would you support someone in that situation without patronizing them?
Oh, what a good question. So if I was to support Hans, I would try to think to myself that he is a legendary composer, isn't he? But he's in, he hasn't had actually much experience in performing. And he's very open about that as well. He always says, oh, if it wasn't for the performers around me, then I wouldn't have my music played out loud. And then he's really appreciative of his performers. I never gave him any advice. I wouldn't do that. But I think some other people have said to him, yeah, it's fine. You just relax. You pretend that there's one person in the audience. And yeah, that's the advice I would give to young people. Just pretend there's one person in the audience. Talk to one person. I actually remember my mum telling me that years and years ago when I was 10 years old. And you know how those things just stick in your head. She said, oh, I love hearing this person speak in the concert because they sound like they're just speaking to one person. And he speaks to the audience like he speaks to me. And then I thought, oh, that's nice. I wish I could do that someday. Because I was so nervous at speaking to the audience before when I was a teenager. And when I was 10 years old and younger, I had to do that. There was one time in school when I got up to play a piano piece and then I couldn't do it. I sat down again. I've been through all of these times.
Because it's interesting, because you've picked up on the stage fright thing as being about speaking and communicating in between songs, right? But it's interesting that you then said, okay, you got up to perform behind a piano. What stopped you in that situation? Was it not fully knowing the part? Was it the fear of playing the wrong notes? Was it the fear that afterwards you'd have to introduce, or before you'd introduce the song or anything like that? What specifically was the blocker in that situation?
Oh, actually, this is a very important thing that I've learned. I did not realize until maybe as recent as 2 years ago that the performance is practice. It's not possible that however many times you repeat something over and over again, and however many times you even visualize and repeat, it can help, of course, to visualize that you're in the performance setting, but the real practice comes during performance for some reason. It's just mentally different and you get the adrenaline and you're trying to give something to the audience. When you're practicing on your own, you have no one to give to. Then, and music is such a form of communication. You need the audience for that. And I didn't realize that when I was 10 years old, standing there trying to play my piano piece and walked off. But that, I think that was the thing. I thought, oh gosh, I'm not used to this. I'm used to being on my own in the practice room. I can't give what I've learned to all these people. It's too scary.
Interesting, because you come back to practice quite a lot. It's interesting work you're using in regards to like your own development. Also interesting, the point you've just made about performing to kind of yourself really in the practice room. I've done some work with a guy who creates virtual environments for people to learn within. And so he's done things with like the England rugby team. So if you're practicing taking penalties in a rugby tournament and it's just a practice, but with no one there, it's not the same as the pressure. And so he creates headsets and that kind of things, and he does it for surgeons. So they practice in high pressure environments, doing heart surgery and stuff like that. Maybe there's a chance to actually create that for someone. So it's like playing the O2 or something like that. I don't know. But interesting how as much practice as you might put in, it's different when you get to the live setting. You were seen as a bit of a child prodigy when it came to music. What barriers do you think existed for you, perhaps as a female drummer or female percussionist going into the music industry back then? And do you think those barriers still exist?
That's interesting. I was just talking to a friend the other day about this. And the truth is, I appreciate you asking, but the reason why I don't like talking about it is because I feel like music is genderless. And I feel like I'm not paying attention to any gender when I'm playing, and I feel genderless when I'm playing. And I haven't had personally any bad experiences being a female. The more problems I've had is being young. And sometimes when I was younger, I felt like I wasn't being taken seriously at some points. And also when you're young, there's times when you shouldn't speak up because you're just not there yet. Just like as simple as giving the older person the front seat in the car. It's just a form of politeness. But yeah, I don't know. A lot of people have had barriers with this, of course, and I wouldn't ever say that it's not a real thing. But for me personally, that's how I feel. I would like people to not notice this anymore. But that's what we're working on.
That's great that you've had that experience, that you don't feel anything in your experience needed to change. And maybe that's that you surround yourself with good people and that kind of thing. And maybe it's a reflection of where you went to at the college and the fact you felt perhaps not taken seriously. Yeah, I can imagine that as like a young musician coming through, particularly being a bit of a prodigy. I think a lot of people I do a lot of teaching, and I know if I teach someone who's older than me, I still have that little kind of voice on my shoulder. But often people are like, no, I want to learn new ways of doing things. These are younger people coming through, teaching me this kind of new world that we're immersed in. That's great. So tell us about, let's go back to that gig, the Hammersmith Apollo, the first one, because it was such a sharp ascension to playing such a high profile gig. Tell us your memories about how you prepared for that so that you walked on stage in a good place, ready to perform such a high profile gig and prestigious gig at the Hammersmith Apollo. How did you go about the preparation from when you got that email to being on stage and feeling comfortable?
I was very excited about it because in college you play in orchestra and play solo, and it was a lot of classical stuff. And also I'd play drums sometimes in big bands and with my dad. But this gig was different because I could really lift my arms up. I was playing the surdo, which we had to act like it was a taiko. And I love playing the taiko. So I could really go for it, be very physical, and I have to reach the eyes of the person at the back of the hall. So I was allowed to do that. And in an orchestra, you can't do that. You have to be very controlled and play your tambourine very controlled. And yeah, I just love to let go in these kind of film music, in these film music shows. And it's very emotional, this show. It's very emotional. And everyone's moving around and rocking out and this fusion between classical and rock music. Yeah. So I don't know how I prepared. I just couldn't wait to let loose, basically.
In regards to receiving the music beforehand, are you given all, is it given to you and you, or do you have to transpose anything? Do you, or is it literally served up on a plate to you and you have to just kind of read it?
Yeah, I just forgot about all of this work.
I was going to say, like it's...
I've been doing it for quite a few years now and I forgot all of the work I did before. But we were given skeleton scores, basically. So we had to transcribe quite a lot of stuff. So there were six of us to start with. Also, so Holly Madge was involved and Aisha Djigeli, Vicky O'Neill and Sarah. She's called Sarah Sticks on Instagram. And am I missing someone? I'm missing someone. Karina Sylvester, who's a great player in the West End. And we all had to transcribe these parts together, the six of us, and Mike Dolbear, who was leading the rehearsals. Because we just had a couple of frotchets here and there and maybe on one line, because during the session, that's when you decide what instruments to play and they're all trying to create together in the session. So that's why there's not much information on the score. And that was really a lot of work, like angels and demons. That was the most fun to put together. But I love this kind of stuff. So fascinated by it. And I love to listen, especially even to the samples and see, oh, how can I create these samples with live instruments? What's the closest sound to this? And maybe if I put this on top of a djembe or something, then it will make this kind of synthy sound.
And you got a metal bucket on the last tour, is that right? Nice, nice. You once said having a great portfolio career allows you to experience different types of leadership. So what leadership preference or style most gets the best out of you? And how was Hans as a leader?
Yeah, of course, leadership varies a lot between the different genres. And I'm just trying to think about that because it's a very interesting question. And how do I feel about the differences between that as well? And yes, I was right before that you can learn from each style of leadership, of course. I'll start with Hal Hansis as a leader. You can tell when he's in a good mood and you can tell when he's in a bad mood. But it was all very good on the 2016 tour, the first one that we had when all the music was fairly new. Everyone was putting it together. And we, because it was with the electronic track, we would, because there are so many reasons with the why it's with backing track, because there are so many very special synth sounds that just, I love to replace them, but they just simply can't be replaced. They have to be there to capture the essence of the soundtrack. So we were playing along with the track and with in-ears, and we'd just play along a couple of times. And during those times, because he trusts that, this is how I see it, that he trusts the musicians so much that he knows that we will work ourselves out. And if he hears something, which he will hear something if something's up, then he will say, he hears everything, every detail. Yeah, but he's, of course, a very good leader and very respectful and supportive. The working with conductors is, I've had very nice experiences, and you get all kinds of different conductors. I remember when I was in the National Youth Orchestra, for example. You want to hear some of my crazy, my scariest experiences?
Yes, please.
The first was when I was playing the Lion's Roar in the, which one was it? It was Varese in Jerez. And it was Semyon Bychkov conducting. And I was quite young at that time. I think I was 15 or 16. And I had this Lion's Roar part, and it's very exposed. And as a percussionist at the back of the orchestra, you're the only one playing that instrument. You can't hide behind the string players or anything. And he would look at me every time, and I'd go, ah! Now, quick! Do you know what the Lion's Roar is? It's a really cool instrument.
No, I don't, sadly.
Yeah, I was just thinking you probably don't know, because I didn't know before I played that piece. It's basically a drum with just one skin on the bottom, and it has a string inside of it, and it sounds like a very deep lion.
Oh, nice.
Or a fart.
So my question around leadership is, how does being a leader sit with you, and what have you taken from some of these other leaders into your own approach as a leader? Because I know you're writing an opera and you've led a lot of stuff in the past. So how does that sit with you?
Ah, well, my favourite experience and most strong leadership experience was probably when I was doing a concert in Zurich, in the Tonhalle in Zurich. I had some musicians playing in the band who were inspirations to me. Alex Wilson, who I was on a music course with when I was a teenager, and Dave Marks, who is a fantastic bass player who I greatly respect and look up to. And Alexei Gudisman, who is part of the Gudisman and Jew and is the most fantastic violinist. And Irina Pack as well, great violinist. So I looked up to all of these musicians to start with, but I had to lead them. And we were also playing my own compositions. So I had to find a way to show respect, but also to have not authority to feel like I was in charge, but authority so that people wouldn't, so it would be efficient. That's right. So I had to think quickly and plan rehearsals ahead. Sometimes it's not possible to plan that much because things happen in rehearsal and you have new ideas, or you need to change the structure slightly of a piece, or maybe you need to change some chords. And we had to change some chords at one point. And then I think being a leader isn't exactly about being what most people think of as a leader. It's about being open to the people who you're leading, because they really appreciate that, and taking their ideas into account. As a leader, you don't have to have all the ideas. And it's a very difficult one to explain, but whoever you are and whoever's playing in your band or ensemble, it is always important to have respect. Even if you're 40 and you're playing in a group of 10-year-olds, if one of them has an idea or one of them wants to say something about what they think, then you must listen to that idea with respect and with an open mind. Because even if they say, oh, I want to turn the drum upside down, maybe it actually works. Maybe there's something in that. Oh, okay, we should try it. Because you could just be an idiot and you had never thought of that before.
What's your go-to phrase if you hear the idea and you don't think it will work that you will then feed back to that person?
Yeah, never say no. I've been taught this. You have to try it out.
Interesting. Right, so rather than actually saying, I don't think that's great, but we might park it and do it later, you try out every single idea, even if someone said, I'm going to turn the drum upside down.
Yeah.
It's important that creative people get heard, I guess, and so... That's nice. Okay, here's a question then. What would you do if there was a time constraint on that?
Oh, yeah, that's the hard one. You say you will try it next time. Great idea. I would really love to try it, but I'm a bit concerned about the time. Let's think realistically about this.
Yeah. Nice. Obviously, I mentioned earlier a bit of a child prodigy and you won a lot of competitions and got recognised as like a BBC Young Musician of the Year and stuff like that. We have a lot of emerging artists listen to this podcast, and we actually have a lot of established artists. And how did that kind of sit with you? And maybe it's not something you even really noticed or thought about, but that kind of probably quite likely at a young age that it was thought that you would go on and become a professional musician who's playing in arenas and fantastic concert halls and very respected as you are. But then you had that expectation of it not being fulfilled yet. How did you find that kind of a journey? How did you handle that? And what advice would you give to someone else who was like, you're going to be a well-known musician in a few years' time, no doubt about it. How do you deal with that pressure?
Oh, well, I had a strange mix in my mind when I was growing up because I was very happy that I won the BBC Young Musician of the Year 2010. I was really overjoyed and I wasn't expecting it. If you look at the film, they call my name and there you go. I really didn't think that was...
I styled my haircut on your one from that night.
Oh, so then I've changed it now.
Yeah.
But yeah, there were two things stuck in my mind. Firstly, from when I was when I first started the drums, I wanted to be a soloist and play around the world. At the same time, I saw my parents and I saw that they have a nice house and they have a nice life. They travel just 15 minutes in the car to go and teach, and they make a living, they eat nicely, that they live, and I would be very happy with that. It's a very nice life. And then when I started doing the shows with Hans Zimmer and other great projects, and even starting to play around Europe, I never thought that I'd be touring around Europe, even though I had this idea in my head still that I want to be a great soloist, I want to be a fantastic percussionist, I'm going to try my best. And now, this is the weird thing. After going through childhood and ending childhood, where people... No, that's not right. But there's a point where you're not a child anymore, but you're still a musician. And then, instead of being a child musician and quite good, you're then an adult in the sea of adults in the whole world. And now, instead of looking at my peers and then taking inspiration of them, I look at big stars and think, oh gosh, I'm not a child anymore. I should be at this level. And that is not so healthy, I think. And I'm trying to get past that. But yeah, it's important, I think, to mention, because I think a lot of people go through this. Suddenly you hit the 25 to 30 and you think, oh my God, I should be way better than I am. Suddenly, in 5 minutes, on your birthday, you should suddenly take a huge leap in standard. But
once you get to the level of those people, they're probably thinking it the same about others anyway. So it's just like an endless cycle of, and that's true. You know, we know people, you know, I'm sure we both know people who are at the absolute top of their game or perceived to be at the top of their game. And they're just riddled with, a kind of anxiety or imposter syndrome, thinking they should be better. They're going to get found out at some stage. Very common. So I think we just need to normalize conversation.
people talk about that as well, who I've met and who I really look up to. And I think, what? It just doesn't make sense. And one of my favorite bass players ever, I heard say it, and I thought, this is just doesn't make sense to me. But of course, I feel it. And what I was going to say is, I have to realize, and I do realize somewhere inside of me, that it's a long climb up. And this is what pushes us to have the inspiration to get better. Just a little bit of this uncomfortable feeling of, oh, I have to be better. It does push and makes the whole music industry better, actually, and makes us all take inspiration further and further.
What about when you started getting a little bit more recognized? So when people you didn't know would know who you are, that's got to be weird, right? That has got to be so weird, particularly as a young person.
Yeah, I guess it was, to start with, it was strange, but I've been quite lucky. I've got some really nice fans, actually. One of them endorses me through this company called Music Traveler, where you can book rooms anywhere in the world, can just book people's houses, and then you can practice there for an hour or two or 7 hours, however much you pay for. It's really useful. So they've got a few cities ongoing now, like Vienna and Munich and some other places around Europe. London is up and coming, which is really good news. And yeah, sometimes he gives me these little payments and it's so lovely. And another one who just always talks about timbales says, oh my God, you've done a timbale video. I love timbales. And then, when are you going to do the next timbale video? So that's really nice. Yeah, really jolly people. And so, I like it when people are joking in the comments and on my page and making fun of it. Good old English humour, taking the piss of it.
Nice. What's one gig that you've played, or concert performance you've done, that if you could, go and sit in the audience and watch from the audience perspective?
One that I've done, well, of course, the Hans Zimmer show. I've actually been able to sit in the audience and see it. I've seen the Hans Zimmer live show in the audience, and it's better than I expected. I really loved it. And I would want to see most shows in the audience. Yeah, I really enjoy seeing a few orchestral concerts now and again. And I just went to watch the Bayerischer Rundfunk, who I've never played with, but it's nice to watch an orchestra after being part of an orchestra for 4 years in college. Yeah.
And what was one gig you went to below the age of, say, 20, that was really defining? Not necessarily in your career, but just in your life, like this. I think every listener to this will be able to think, yeah, going to that gig or that weekend that we went to see that artist, everything changed from then. You know, was there a particular gig or performance that you went to that was really defining?
Oh, well, that's hard. There's so many. I'm a huge Pat Metheny fan. And we went to see Pat Metheny in the Barbican with my uncle and my dad. And my drum teacher at the time as well, Steve Hines. And also my future drum teacher back then, who's now my ex-drum teacher, Ralph Sammons, who's a legend. We saw Pat Metheny play, and Antonio Sanchez was playing as well, one of my favorite drummers. And it's just, I don't understand how he does it with these harmonies. And there was so much energy on stage, of course. Oh my God. And there was another one where we saw Vinnie Colaiuta, and oh gosh, it's too long ago. Oh, Christian McBride. Yeah. Vinnie Colaiuta and Christian McBride. And that was like nothing I've ever seen. Vinnie is an amazing drummer. So those two gigs, really. I think the Barbican has some really good stuff on. Oh, it did anyway. When I was young.
Yeah, classic venue in London. So what's something you're really obsessed about right now in regards to your own music? So is there something you're really particularly focused on, such as your opera?
Oh, yes, I'm very focused on the opera at the moment. Yeah. It was a guy called Stefan Knies who asked me to compose for his opera. He's directing and writing the libretto. He's basically finished the libretto, and I'm now composing the music to go with that. The Wizard of Oz, So we're following the story of the original book, but it's condensed into 60 minutes because it's going to be for the family friendly, but also friendly to people who are just being introduced to opera, not necessarily children. So I'm writing it in my style, which is some strange fusion between classical and jazz. There's no Latin in it yet. But I find this very interesting because then we can try to find new possibilities for opera. And this is how new things generally start. Someone comes over, the Cuban music, for example, the Africans came over and they have I hope I'm telling the right story, but the very, very short story is they have actually similar style of salsa that they call something else in the Congo, I think. So everything came from somewhere, and the Argentinian tango and the Piazzolla, there's a whole story there and lots of crossovers. And it's quite important to try to push things out of their natural habitat. And I'm very excited about this. I know that I'll like listening to it. I hope that I don't. Always the worry is offending someone or not paying enough respect to a style of music. And I want to pay a lot of respect and show my admiration for opera at the same time as injecting my own style into it. So as well as listening to the classic operas and trying to be inspired by them, I'm also trying to keep a certain distance so that it doesn't interfere too much with my own style. If you really are true to what you like and you put that in your composition, then that's the best that you can write. You're really giving your best then. If you try to be someone else, you'll always be the second best to the person you're trying to be.
It seems a natural progression in your career and your compositions to do this now and start going to writing operas. If you were to find out right now, put it on the news, and there's going to be an asteroid that hits the Earth tomorrow and life is going to end, what would be your biggest regret musically, having not got round to doing?
I would like to do more solo concerts of my own compositions.
And what's stopping you doing it, I guess?
It's the logistics and sending a lot of emails. Things like this, very technical things that actually are not taught in college. And this is something that's important for young people as well to know, that a musical career is not all about practicing. It's about socializing. Go to the pub. It was the right thing to do to go to the pub. Socialize, make friends, and make important connections. And after you've done a concert, go and have the meal with the promoter and meet people who were involved. It's just very important to get to know everyone that you can. And some lifelong friends are made out of that as well.
And you might have just answered this question, but in case that isn't the answer to this question, what's one quality or skill that's really underrated that you think all musicians listening to this should acquire, regardless of their instrument?
A skill that's underrated? Well, improvisation. Because improvisation can open a new pathway in your mind, and it's like instant composition. When you're improvising, you're really using a different part of your brain, a subconscious part of your brain. Bringing that subconscious forward is really useful for general performance in classical music as well. Some people, there's this pianist who, the name leaves me right now, but there are quite a few classical pianists who can also improvise very well, and it saves them sometimes in concertos. I've heard some of them say, oh, I was about to make a mistake, but then I just improvised.
You are something special, Romois, 20 carat solid gold. What we had was precious, Romois, but I had to let you go.
And when you ventured into different worlds, so you did the thing with Charlie XCX on the Live Lounge, I wonder if you could tell us a bit about how, when you work with different artists from, say, rock sensibility, how that differs. Does that stretch you in any different way? Do you actually feel quite that some of the parts are actually easier and maybe not as complex? How do you feel stepping into that world?
That was so much fun. And I was really excited to bring some of my knowledge to that setting because I knew about the Brazilian and Cuban grooves, and that fits so nicely into that style of music and the instruments as well. I brought a few instruments along and then just trying to find the grooves that fit. But I was also playing the mallet cats because I was playing some tune stuff. And because Muramasa had composed on electronic digital audio workstations, it was actually very hard. The tune stuff was really hard to get my sticks around, but I really wanted to learn it. So I was determined and I got the coordination. We played Firefly. If you listen to the beginning of that, Firefly's got a really nice marimba part.
And tell us about some of the people you've worked with, any kind of specific memories or things you learned from working. So you did some stuff with Pharrell Williams, Stuart Copeland, Johnny Marr. You played on stage with Johnny Marr, is that right?
Yeah. He was on part of the Hans Zimmer tour in 2016 as well. And he's a really lovely guy and also very funny. Really great guitarist, yeah.
And Pharrell Williams?
And Pharrell, he was on stage for one show. That was the Hammersmith Apollo show. We played Happy and I played the Shakers. That was so much fun. Yeah, adrenaline levels were through the roof on that one.
But what a baptism of fire. If you are a young musician and you're working with these kind of high profile people for the first time, what's your advice to stay reasonably centered and not feel out of your depth? Because I think that could be an easy kind of trap to fall into. What's your advice working with high profile people for the first time?
You can always learn from these people. And it's important to surround yourself with people who inspire you all the time. So if you're nervous about talking to someone who's got a very high profile, then that's the reason to do it. And generally, they all love to inspire young players or enthusiastic people. Everyone loves someone coming up to you and asking you something enthusiastic. And also that there are people as well, as we were saying earlier, with those kind of worries sometimes. And I adapted a bit because I realized after that gig, especially that everyone has a conversation and an interesting story. And of course, these people have interesting stories, but you just have to find out. You have to put the shyness aside and just go and speak and have a conversation with them.
Nice. Now, those who follow our The Stage Left podcast on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook feeds will know that myself and John Woff from the 975, we ran the London Marathon 5 weeks ago, and I flew over to New York and went and saw their show at Madison Square Garden last week, and with the aim of actually doing a run of Hudson River, which I won't tell you why. I got dumped Jimmy Fallon show, unfortunately, so we couldn't get around to it. But we've got this plan that when they go on tour to go running in lots of different cities, and I know that you said in the past that running in different cities is one of the favourite things about touring. So if there were two cities that you'd recommend, Chris, go to this city and this city to do some running, which are the two that you'd recommend?
I live in Vienna, but I love Vienna. And Munich, Paris is also good. Prague, oh, had a great run around Prague. Aix-en-Provence is so beautiful. Oh, one of my very favourites is in the Basque country in Bilbao. Yeah, go running in Bilbao. There's some hills as well. And then when you get, it's just a small hill, really, and big hill, small mountain. And then when you get to the top, you have an amazing view. Amazing.
I've only trained for flat surfaces, so we might have to mix that one. Now, you once, I think, wrote some music, a healing process for those dealing with specific mental health problems. Tell us about your approach to that and the reason why you did that.
It all started when my friend Sarah Stewart asked me to write the yoga piece for her because she suffers with a rare condition called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And also POTS and also some other things. And basically, it means that her blood circulation doesn't go round so well, which means that at a point she had to do yoga every day to keep her blood circulation moving. So she said, oh, would you write me a yoga piece because you're now composing? That was a while ago. Oh, and it was in 2016 I wrote the first one. And I thought, oh, yeah, sure, have a go at that. And I just wrote it in a day or two. And I wrote something that I thought in my mind was quite generic. I just tried to write a generic yoga piece that could be played on a live instrument, like vibraphone. And I liked it a lot. And then I recorded it properly and I sent it to her. And then my other friend, she was struggling a lot with OCD. She was in the specialist OCD hospital. And there was one day when she rang me, I remember this, she had a problem with showering because it was all about rituals and how to complete a ritual before you can move on to the next. So the amount of time she would wash her hair or the amount of time she would squeeze the bottle or something. And she did that with a supervisor. And the supervisor said, I'm right here, don't worry. Just have a normal shower. And if anything happens, I'm here to catch you. And she did. And she rang me after that and she said, oh my God, Lucy, I just had a normal shower and anything is possible if you put your mind to it. It's amazing. She was so happy. And this was a huge step for her. And I wrote her a healing piece it's not about OCD exactly. It's about a safe place, because I said what makes her feel relaxed and she said a safe place. So the piece is called Safe Place and it's to put her in the safe place when she's feeling like she needs a bit of help. And then the rest came as well. There's a piece called Home, which is about finding where your home is. There's a piece written for an artist called Circles and a piece for sleeping better. I always say the positive rather than the condition, because otherwise you get reminded too much of it. And I've got more on the go as well.
Largely the music that you write and compose doesn't have lyrics. Do you have like lyrics in mind or a story in mind or some, do you ever write lyrics or poetry so that keeps the piece of music on track, so you know that this is what it's about? Where does that factor within this?
Yeah, the title and the subject already gives me the feeling. And the nice thing about composing is that you don't have to think of the words to describe what you're trying to talk about. Sometimes it's easier to say it through music. So the answer is no, really. But it is a nice idea, and maybe I should actually try to do that.
Interesting. Having worked with Hans Zimmer so closely, do you watch films differently now, listening to the drums?
Oh, I just think it's even more epic now. Oh, and Dune. Have you seen Dune?
I have. Yeah, I have.
God, that drum, the drum solo inside of it, this frame drum, I learned the secret behind that.
Go on.
We had a private gig in Cannes quite recently. It was last minute for the BBC for the release of Hans's new documentary. So we went to dinner with him the night before and I said, please tell me who recorded that drum part. And he said, it was me. I just typed it in the MIDI. And then they went,
oh.
Because it's so amazing. It makes complete sense that he had to write a very abstract rhythm, because it's a completely different world. They don't have the rhythmic system that we have over here. So we had to try and create something completely new. And that's why when I was trying to learn it, because I had to perform it in that gig, we had the click track listening to the rhythm. And before that, I thought, okay, this rhythm will become clear when I have the click track. Nope. It has absolutely no correlation with any beat whatsoever.
Have you ever been in a situation where something technical has really gone wrong on stage, such as the click track not working and stuff like that, and you've had to, let's say it happened at one of those huge concerts. I'm sure it wouldn't happen, but let's say it did. What in those 3 or 4 seconds would you advise someone to be thinking in those seconds if there was a massive technical issue that they could still have kind of control over?
Listen to the drummer. Yeah, it happened once in soundcheck, the click track run out. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. And I kept playing for a bit. But then by then, everyone was a bit shaken up and panicked. We stopped. But I thought, okay, that's what to do if it happens in the show. Just keep playing. And if it's really a disaster, then people are forgiving. If something technical goes wrong, it's no one's fault. And you just have to deal with it in a relaxed way.
Nice. In a relaxed way. See, that's the key, isn't it?
You're asking me all of these questions, which I'm answering now at this age. And if you'd asked me all of these questions 5 years ago, I would have answered slightly differently and, of course, with slightly less experience. And that's something that's missing when you're giving an interview and you're trying to educate young people, that they don't realize that it was a whole process to get to this realization.
And hopefully, you know, for some of those people listening, this might be a bit of a shortcut. This might kind of help them in some way, you know, hearing those little kind of nuggets, golden nuggets of advice, you know, from yourself that might help them in those types of situations. Last couple of questions before we wrap up. If you had one more hour in the day, other than sleep and practice, what would you do with it?
Yeah, it would really be nice to have another hour in the day. And that would mean that I can fit everything in. I already try to fit everything in, and I really love climbing and sports. I love running as well. And that would mean I could go climbing more and get better at it, because all of my concentration goes at getting better at music. Yeah, I could do some harder levels maybe.
Nice. Nice answer. Nice to get a bit of an insight about the other stuff you do. Last two questions. What's one question you'd love if anyone asked you? It's if there was one kind of piece of work that you've done or something like that, you think, I wish someone asked me about that, but they never bloody do.
So many things, isn't that? There's how to play many different styles of music, maybe, and about playing with a Gudesman and Jew, because that's quite interesting to incorporate humour into playing. Because during rehearsal, you have to be serious, but still having fun. And the whole point of the show is to have fun. That's the reason why the humour exists there. And I think that is a great life lesson to have, because music really should be fun. And Hans always said, music is playing. The main word in our career is to play. So we should be playful.
What a great bit of wisdom that is passed on through you from Hans. If there was one thing, last question, if there's one thing you could change about the music industry for one day, and if you're president for one day and you could change one law or rule, create a rule, what would it be? What's one thing you'd change about the music industry?
Everyone needs to have more fun, and sometimes it's not necessary to be so serious. That's the main one. Because then you create more if you have more fun. And when you get on stage, there's no point in being serious, because you need to access different parts of your mind. So if you're pretending already to be someone else or have a shield in front of you to try and be professional, that's why musicians have managers, to do the professional work, and the musician should be very open and truthful and honest, so that there's less transition when you go on stage, and then you can open up to the audience and communicate. But I don't really know. That's the first thing I thought of.
I think that's a great answer. And listen, I want to thank you for your transparency, your kind of wisdom that you've passed on, the advice that you've passed on. You've had an incredible career, and obviously you're still quite a young person. So, you know, I think we all know where you're going to be when you're kind of double your age, and you're going to have you're going to be very, very highly respected for what you do, even more so than you are now. And I just want to thank you for all that advice you've given to our listeners. And thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left podcast.
Thank you, Chris. It was really nice to speak to you.
Enjoy the rest of your evening. Catch you later. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
This episode was edited and mixed by Bastian Hughes, Bastianhues. And that's little Eliza Day, my baby, who's making a bit of noise in the background, giving the endorsement to Bastian. You should get in touch with him on Instagram, whether you need support with your mixing, your editing, your scoring, or your website design, Bastianhues. He's doing a great job.